This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 18th of July, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs, broadcasted right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily, and of course, The 10. Coming up.
It's a very good deal for what it represents. It's brought together Europe, America, the Russians, the Chinese, and it's actually brought Iran significantly back into the fold. That can't be bad.
After Iran and world powers strike a deal on its nuclear program, we hear how it was covered this week on Midori House. Plus, we reflect on Starbucks' move to South Africa. And after all that, we get hot and steamy in the Arctic Circle.
We would like to create an experience where people are, of course, sweating next to another person, but at the same time, we also offer other kinds of experiences.
All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. Now, Africa is not reported nearly enough in the world beyond it, and when it is, it's often reported badly. It's far more likely that this will be remedied by African journalists than by global news agencies whose headquarters and audiences are elsewhere, which is why the David Astor Awards are important. Named for the former Observer editor who championed African causes, the awards encourage young African journalists at the start of what will hopefully be stellar careers. This year's winners, Jacqueline Kubania from Kenya's Daily Nation, Gloria Nakajubi from Uganda's New Vision, and Solomon Arena Itwe from Uganda's Daily Monitor, all came by Midori House to speak to our executive editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Kenya, in terms of media freedom, is doing much better than a lot of countries. But that also means that we face a unique set of challenges when it comes to coverage of some news items. There's difficulty in accessing information. There's sometimes also difficulty in getting sources to talk to you, especially if it's a sensitive issue that you're covering. Of course, bureaucracy in government institutions just makes media coverage all that more difficult. You have to really, really go the extra mile and do a bit of investigative journalism to produce a story that's worth writing.
And do you find that you're having problems with government trying to stop you reporting?
Well, what the government will do is not to directly say, don't publish this. They will just make it a lot more difficult for you to do so in withholding information, for instance. Okay, let me give you an example. I did a story about cancer treatment in Kenya. Kenya has only two radiotherapy machines, and they had both broken down at the same time, meaning that the radiotherapy patients couldn't access treatment of any sort. And so what the government tried to do at that time was to give a wrong narrative, to discount what the patients were saying and to try to show the journalists that the machines are working, which they aren't. That's the kind of thing you have to contend with every day. It's the government refusing to acknowledge problems, and sometimes that removes from the authority of your story.
And Gloria Nakajubi, you work for the New Vision in Kampala.
Yeah.
We're going to have elections in Uganda next year. Does the imminence of elections make your job as a reporter harder, or is it more exciting?
I think since I'm not directly a political reporter, I don't think that would really affect me, because only what it actually does is it takes away the focus. It's basically there will be like more space for politics other than my stories, which you sometimes you actually find they're more relevant to the part of the common people than this whole hullabal about politics. But so basically the political year tends to undermine the other stories, which is really my interest. So it kind of gets tricky during the political year. It's really about politics, and sometimes really the real issues are neglected.
And Solomon, you're a political reporter at the Daily Monitor. How difficult is it to cover politics in Uganda, particularly as you approach an election?
In terms of heightened political activity in Uganda always really very difficult and challenging for the media. I mean, the last time there's a major clampdown on the media was just after the 2011 elections, which were followed by opposition-led protests against rising costs of living, which inflation had been caused by a lot of money being powered into the economy by government to buy the election. So the attacks on journalists just being beaten up, kicked, and intimidation and switching off social media with the coming election next year in Uganda, for instance, the government communications, which regulates both broadcast media and banned large print media, has already issued a warning about what it calls running information from unverified accounts. You know, it's a euphemism for saying, look, you shouldn't run stories which you haven't sort of verified with government. Okay, it makes journalistic sense to verify a story with government. But what they mean here is that, look, you shouldn't run a story without getting green light or consent from government. I mean, in the run-up to election, it inevitably heightens and makes the clampdown on independent media more severe than it has been before.
Jackie, is that something that you're experiencing in Kenya as well, that government are increasingly finding new ways to try and prevent you reporting?
Oh, yes, definitely. There are, for instance, the Communications Act that was enacted, I think, sometime last year, has just made it so much more difficult to be a journalist in Kenya because the journalist is now personally liable for some of the stories he or she publishes that are deemed to be libelous or defamatory. And personal liability means that the journalist is fined personally or is actually even faces jail time. You know, that just makes you antsy. It makes you very uneasy about some of the stories you might have to cover.
And does that mean that journalists then tend to self-censor?
Of course, you tend to shy away from some potentially inflammatory stories, and to play it safe because you don't want the government coming down on you. That just makes it a lot more difficult to be a journalist and to tell the stories you really, really want to tell.
That was Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, talking to the winners of this year's David Astor Awards for Monday's episode of the Monocle Daily. You're listening to Monocle 24. This week we heard that after more than a decade of frosty relations and on-off negotiations, world powers had finally reached a deal with Iran regarding its nuclear program. It'll see Iranian nuclear activity reined back in return for the lifting of international economic sanctions. On Tuesday's episode of Midori House, Tom Edwards heard the view from his guests, Raffaella Pantucci, who's Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute here in London, and also Quentin Peel, an associate fellow at Chatham House and a contributor for the Financial Times.
I think it's as good as we could have possibly hoped for, really. It's clearly not perfect. It's not going to be easy to enforce. And it is going to infuriate, as you hinted, two particular countries, Israel and Saudi Arabia. And it'll have a very difficult passage through the US Congress because Israel will pull out every stop to try and block it. But I think that it's a very good deal for what it represents. It's brought together Europe, America, the Russians, the Chinese, and it's actually brought Iran significantly back into the fold. That can't be bad.
Raffaella, we'll perhaps talk about Israel and the Saudis in a moment, but for exactly the reasons that Quentin identifies there, this is presumably a moment that we should be marking, well, if not celebrating, certainly marking with some degree of enthusiasm.
I certainly think it's a very positive moment, but I do think that there are some quite substantial problems that are sort of lurking on the horizon. And actually, I think what's quite interesting as well, it generates a lot of goodwill, certainly between the EU and US, showing that, you know, we can do these sorts of deals and that, you know, sanctions, if applied with enough rigor and diplomatic engagement, can really turn around a situation which was perceived to be as, you know, impossible to break. The worry for me is what are the sort of secondary and tertiary consequences of this act? You know, nothing ever happens happens in a vacuum, you know, and the consequences of this, and I think the repercussions. I actually think Israel, you know, I think there's sort of workable ways with that, but I think the implications to the other Gulf countries and their thinking and how concerned they are, and in fact, how concerned they are about what this means about the growing relationship between Iran and the West. You know, you look at Iran, it's a country of, what, 90 million people? It's got a relatively functioning industrial base. It's got a relatively functioning economy, which is now going to be unleashed. You know, and you put that up against a Saudi economy or a lot of the other Gulfy ones, which is basically extractives and a small elite who are sort of, you know, keeping all the money while everyone else is ill-educated. And, you know, it's just, it could have a real game-changing geopolitical shift, which I don't know if we've really seen the sort of longer-term consequences of that.
Quentin, do you think that, I mean, has there been any sort of short-termism then in terms of some of the parties who are involved in this not being alive to those consequences? Or do you think that they were well aware of them and they decided that, nevertheless, this was a course of action that had to be pursued to its end?
I think the latter. I think they were very well aware of them. I think that, I mean, there's been this poison in the Middle East between Shia and Sunni, the constant rivalry there, and it's got to be dealt with at some stage. The boil has got to be lanced. It can't go on just poisoning the atmosphere interminably. And I do not really see how this deal makes it worse. I realise that obviously a country like Saudi might turn around and say, this is going to allow them to have nuclear weapons, therefore we've got to have nuclear weapons too. But that would be right in the face of the Americans. It would. I just don't think. I think it is a better deal to at least grab the chance of restraining Iran from going down that route. Can't be bad.
Now, Rafaela, we talked about Israel. The reaction has obviously been as forthright as perhaps we would have expected. You've had Netanyahu, who's called it a historical mistake. The deputy foreign minister called it a historic surrender by the West and continued with this phrase that, to the axis of evil headed by Iran, using this sort of rhetoric that most involved in the negotiations seem to have moved on from. Unsurprising that that's the rhetoric. I mean, and how do we address the problem of the Israeli attitude to Iran's inclusion in these talks in the first place?
Look, I think, you know, for all my sort of doom and gloom comments before about what the secondary and tertiary consequences are, I think that some sort of deal did have to be reached. You do have to engage with the Iranians, and that's kind of the end of it. And I think that this was the best kind of deal that could be expected. I think, you know, Quentin's spot on the money, frankly, when he talks about, you know, these issues are ones that are hugely problematic and we're always going to upset someone, you know, and with the Israelis, you were always going to have Netanyahu, and Netanyahu particularly administration was going to come out very strongly against this, kind of no matter how it was really shaped, and they will continue to. And you can already see people here in London who are, you know, very anti this sort of thing, mobilizing themselves to sort of start lobbying government and shouting about it more. I think that was always going to be a reality, you know, I think, and it really is. And I unfortunately think that what one would hope is that this has changed some sort of a fundamental thing that means that at least this one problem has been addressed. There are lots of other problems as well, and this will make some of them worse, will complicate others. But one would hope that now we can turn and sort of start to look at those. But at least this one has been moved into a sort of more positive direction.
And don't you think, Rafaela, that it's also very interesting that actually within Iran, who was opposing this deal? It was the conservatives in Iran. It was the hardliners in Iran. And actually, here's a very young country and a country with enormous upside possibilities. And I think that to open up rather than to close down relations with a country like that is in the long term going to be much more positive.
A highlight there from Tuesday's episode of Midori House, hosted by Tom Edwards, with Quentin Peel and Rafaela Pantucci. You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows, hosted right here at Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Now, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is hardly a fixture on the global gigs circuit. In fact, no foreign bands ever played in North Korea. But that's all set to change next month. The pathfinders making this unlikely appearance are Laibach, the veteran Slovenian group whose works have often satirized the kind of authoritarian iconography that dominates the DPRK's streetscapes. Does North Korea know what it's letting itself in for? Well, on Wednesday's edition of the Monocle Daily, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson spoke to Morten Travik, the Norwegian artist and director who's organized the trip.
I think they basically are maybe not even in the Venn diagram. they are beyond the Venn diagram. And you could more say that the Venn diagram is just a part of Laibach and not the other way around.
Please tell me, because there are so many things about this story that I'm completely riveted by. And
I'm baffled by the whole thing.
I'm frankly bitter and desperately sad that I'm not able to go, because this is the one show of this decade I think I would most like to see. But how do you go about pitching Laibach, of all people, to North Korean officialdom? How do you get North Korea to sign off on this?
Well, you know, I won't give away all my secrets on the first date.
We're desperate to know, because frankly, we haven't understood how you've done it.
Many people are very curious about that. But to cut the long story short, and I don't think we have that much time, but the key word is trust, mutual trust. And the Laibach concert, it doesn't come out of the blue, even if it might seem so for, you know, seen from the outside. It's actually the product of several years of directing cultural collaborations between North Korean artists and artists, musicians, artists, actors, painters, and so on, from outside North Korea, with pairing them with North Korean artists. So it's really been a process of building mutual trust and understanding, which Laibach is so far the crowning achievement of.
Who are you pairing Laibach with then? You're talking about pairing them with North Korean artistic groups. Is there an equivalent over there that those in North Korea are absolutely bananas about, and you just thought, great, there's a market here, they love a bit of whatever it is, Laibach would absolutely fit the bill?
Yeah, well, that's part of what we're going to find out. The North Koreans have told me that they have prepared some local musicians for us that they would like to perform with us. We hope it will be the Moranbong band, you know, the North Korean Spice Girls, which were supposedly created by the leader himself. You know, he's the kind of stock Aitken Waterman to Moranbong. They're an all-girl band, the first band to perform with electric violins and miniskirts in North Korea. So, of course, for many reasons, we have high hopes that maybe we could do a number with them. But
is this like a really strange blind date, Morten?
In many ways it is, yeah, for all parties involved. Maybe not so much for me. I may be more the matchmaker here, because I've been there before, and probably, you know, I hold quite a lot of people's trust and expectations in my puppet master hands.
I mean, Laibach, of course, began in what was then Yugoslavia in the 1980s, and much of their work was a satire of the militarized authoritarianism of Tito's Yugoslavia, and that is an aesthetic they've pursued ever since. Are they going to have to tone any of that down or alter what they do at all to be permitted to play in North Korea?
Not really, no. The concert will consist of highlights from their career, including the Final Countdown, of course, which you just played, together with some brand new cover versions of Sound of Music songs from the musical Sound of Music. And this is not because of North Korea. This is because me and Laibach have been planning for quite a long time to stage the Sound of Music in the Laibach version. And we think North Korea might be a good place to, you know, test out the seductive mass qualities of the Sound of Music songs. Furthermore, the Sound of Music is actually very near and dear to very many North Koreans, because they're using that musical in their university English curriculum.
That was the Norwegian artist Morten Travik there, talking to Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson on the Monocle Daily on Wednesday. Up next, Starbucks heads south.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGlory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive, and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Since evolving from a tea and spice supply store in the 1970s, Starbucks has garnered something of a reputation for saturation. In New York or LA, it's not uncommon to find one on almost every street corner. But the company's efforts to expand internationally have yielded a mixed bag of results. So with news this week of Starbucks' plan to open in South Africa for the first time, we wondered what it'll take for the company to tap into that particular market. On Thursday's edition of The Globalist, Georgina Godwin was joined by Francesca Dalomo Riley, Associate Professor of Strategy, Marketing and Innovation at Kingston University, right here in the UK.
It might surprise many of us, but Starbucks is, to many Americans, a premium product. Mm-hmm. Is this entirely down to its carefully cultivated brand?
Yes, I would say mostly to do with this carefully cultivated brand. And in fact, the more symbolic and intangible element of the brand, which is what Starbucks means in terms of the experience that you get when you go into a Starbucks coffee shop, and also the, of course, the tangible element, which is the products you get, and then the taste of the coffee.
Mm. The perception of the brand differs wildly, though, between nations and markets. Its offering, though, is famously always the same, no matter where you are. Why has it had such trouble, then, controlling its brand perception?
Well, because actually the brand perception is something which is due to the how the consumer perceives the brand, and therefore the intangible elements, and sometimes is not perceived by the consumer the way that the company intends, and particularly if, say, there are some obvious problems like Starbucks not paying their taxes, perhaps, or being perceived as not paying their taxes, or even, rumours that they're not environmentally friendly and they use too much water in cleaning their equipment, and so on. So a brand, by and large, is liable always of some kind of backlash from the consumer perception, particularly if you're not careful to manage it properly and preempt, in a way, what could be some kind of backlash.
Mm. South Africa has seen some coffee chains popping up offering coffee as a uniquely African product. Mm-hmm. So Starbucks, obviously quite specifically an American brand, do you think its reputation is strong enough to penetrate that African market?
Well, it really depends how Starbucks plays it. You mentioned at the beginning the example of Australia, which is an example of how, in fact, they got it wrong in entering a market, quite different from the South African market, because the Australian market was already quite booming, well-established coffee culture and so on. South Africa, yes, there is a growing market, but perhaps it's not as developed as the Australian market was. So there is a chance for a Starbucks to really establish themselves as a premium coffee brand, perhaps even a play on those elements which have got to do with the sources of their coffee. So they source a lot of coffee from sub-Saharan countries. Perhaps that would fit well with the coffee culture in South Africa and the growing coffee culture, the fact that, yes, they're an American brand, but at the same time, they use a product which is almost local, so they source from Africa.
Mm. And the choice of local partners got to be key, hasn't it? I mean, I think they're going in with Taste. That's a big South African company.
Right.
They already control some household names.
Yes, in fact, Taste is the company which is responsible, so to speak, for introducing Domino's Pizza into South Africa. So if you wish, at the other end of the market, so Domino's Pizza are not very much a premium brand, whereas Starbucks would be a more premium brand, but definitely they have local expertise in terms of real estate, in terms of infrastructure and so on. So potentially is a good partnership.
Mm. And when looking for new territories, a company like Starbucks must surely have to consider things like an aspirational middle class. That's got to be very important.
That's right. That's very important. And that has been very important, for example, in China, where they have been very much an aspirational brand, where being seen with a Starbucks coffee cup is very much a status symbol, although actually the product itself in China may be very different from the product that they sell in other countries, so very much more tea-based in China, green tea and so on. So that's the other element to keep into consideration in South Africa, where the adaptation of the actual product needs to be taken into consideration because of the taste of coffee or South African, whereas the aspiration element, well, that's there, that's perhaps common to other countries.
That was Francesca Dell'Omo Riley, Associate Professor of Strategy, Marketing, and Innovation at Kingston University, talking to Georgina Godwin on Thursday's episode of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Let's head north now to the Arctic Circle for a rather steamy story. The world's largest sauna has opened in Norway as part of the Salt Arts Festival. On Thursday's edition of The Briefing, Tom Edwards spoke to the founder of Salt, Helge Marie Nordby, and also welcomed to the studio Monocle's Marcus Hippe, who as a Finn claims to be something of an authority on sauna going.
A sauna is a place to be together, and we would like to create an experience where people are, of course, sweating next to another person, but at the same time, we also offer other kinds of experiences, like watching out on the beautiful nature through the huge glass window. But also we have installed a permanent sound piece by Biosphere that you could also listen to. So it's this combination of being together, being almost naked, seeing the landscape, and also listening to art.
Well, now, Helge Marie, you mentioned the idea of being almost naked, and there does seem to be a bit of regional difference amongst the Nordic nations about how one should conduct oneself whilst in sauna. And I see that on your sort of press materials, people are very, you know, discreetly dressed with towels or swimming costumes. Some say the only real way to experience sauna is, not with any clothing whatsoever. Is that a bit awkward for the festival, or are people welcome to come as they are?
Well, we say so, of course. People ask, the people who want to be naked, they say, is it okay? And we say, of course, in the sauna you're supposed to be naked, but we also want to be including, so people who doesn't like to be totally undressed can also join us wearing a towel or a bikini or a swimming pants or whatever. But of course, the real experience you can only have through being naked.
Now, Marcus, that's interesting, isn't it, to talk a little bit about the sauna experience. You've seen a couple of these pictures. Have you ever been in a sauna with such a large window as that out onto the beautiful beaches?
I haven't. I see these designs, I see these photos, and I do enjoy this amazing view through that massive glass front of that sauna building. You already pointed out that these people in the photos are wearing towels and so forth, and, you know, in Finland we wouldn't necessarily do that. Another thing I'm wondering about this is the temperature, considering that this building is quite massive. I assume the temperatures are not going to go quite as high as what we are used to in Finland. It's about 80 degrees normally in Finland. It's about 100 Celsius degrees if you are a real pro when it comes to going to sauna.
And well, shall we ask Helge Marie about that? I mean, Helge Marie, how hot does it get in this sauna? Have you turned the needle all the way up so far? Does it get up to 80 Celsius?
Well, almost 80 Celsius. Of course, I mean, this is an amphi, so when you're on the top, it is actually very, very hot. And I think we've been up to 85, actually, on the top. But of course, you can level it out as you move down in the sauna. It gets colder and colder. But actually, when you steam it, I mean, you get really sweaty. And when you go out and you have a swim in the ocean, it's a great experience.
The founder of Salt Arts Festival, Helge Marie Nordby there, and Monocle's own Marcus Hippe, talking to Tom Edwards on The Briefing on Thursday. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. This show is produced by Alice Block and edited by Nina Norick and Wei Dong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for listening, and see you later.